You're listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. In this episode, we hear from Juliet Davenport, Chief Exec of Good Energy, the 100% renewable energy company she founded in 1999. I began by asking Juliet about a typical day at work.
So I think my typical day is not typical. So there are kind of different types of days. So some of the days are, I will go into the office, I will meet with my senior team, I will meet with my direct reports, we'll go through what's going on in the energy sector, what's going on in the business, looking at the strategy, adapting the strategy and delivering really on trying to deliver 100% renewable energy to as many people as possible. I guess as CEO, my role is slightly adaptive. So what it means is that really you have to be looking forward to the strategy, to understanding what the landscape is, what's happening in government, which is always quite complicated, what your customers are saying, how the company is working and performing, and what's going on in the with your competitors. And you kind of have to keep an eye on all of that while trying to support your teams, make sure that they have everything they need to deliver, and work with your investors and making sure that you have sufficient cash in the bank to continue to deliver what you need to do.
Can you tell me a bit about what Good Energy does?
So Good Energy, so I set Good Energy up 20 years ago, and really the purpose of the business stays the same today. So we call our purpose, together with our customers, we want to drive towards a cleaner, greener Britain. And what that really means is that we want to work with customers to allow them to be part of the solution. So that means that yesterday we launched with our business customers that we start delivering EV charging points for them. So that means, particularly for hotels, that people can drive to a hotel in a low carbon way. They can charge at their hotel overnight and then go on their journey the next day. So it's about enabling businesses to go 100% renewable energy, then thinking about, okay, so what's the next thing on the list that they can do to reduce their carbon and the carbon of their customers and their employees?
So you're thinking in quite a different way from a traditional energy company then?
Yes. So, I mean, I think we always have. And part of the reason for that was when we came into the market 20 years ago, everything, we had to change everything, if that makes sense. So we were one of the first people to get an electricity supply license. And we had to change the way the regulator thought about energy supply companies, that they didn't need to just be big, old-fashioned businesses. They could be small and nimble. Then we had to change the way we raised money. So we were one of the first crowdfunded organisations in the UK, because the traditional city looked at us and didn't think we had a business model, but our customers believed in us, and so they invested. So we kind of, each stage over the 20 years, we've had to change the way the energy market or the financial market has worked. And that means that as a business, you're constantly challenging. It's a bit exhausting, to be honest. It means it changes part of your everyday life. But I think if you look at what's happened since we entered the market, so renewables were like about 2% of the electricity produced in the UK was from renewables. Today, I think it's over 40% in this last quarter of our electricity comes from renewables. It's an amazing shift. Now, I can't claim it's all because of us, but we've definitely been part of that change and making sure that that change happens.
I want to go back in time a little bit.
Yeah.
To me, the idea of setting up an energy company just seems like impossible because you have these companies like British Gas are such behemoths, and I can't imagine what would make you think, oh yeah, that's what I want to do. Like, that's a challenge that I want to take on and that I think I can do. So can you talk me a little bit through that?
So I think my passion for doing things came from, in my last year at university, I studied atmospheric physics, which looks at the climate, and climate change is part of that course. And when you've looked at the science of it, you can't get away from it. You can't get away from thinking, oh, climate change isn't real or it's not important. It became centre of what I believed in changing. And so I then kind of tried to find a job, and actually finding a job was very hard. Trying to look at the existing industry didn't really think about climate change, wasn't thinking about climate change at all. There were some small businesses on the edge, mostly consultancies, but not actually doing anything. And I met a German entrepreneur on a trip to Greece when I was talking about renewable energy at a conference. And we both started talking about actually we should empower consumers to be part of this solution. And it was working with him that gave me the confidence. He basically raised the money in Germany. We invested it in the UK and I was the lead on setting up the business. So, but you're right, I knew nothing about it. And I think every day I got out of bed. At that point in my life, to be honest, I wasn't married. I didn't have kids. I didn't have any responsibilities. So you can take that kind of risk every day of your life saying, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow and I'm going to have to figure it out. And that's what we did. But occasionally you just want to sit quietly and say, can everything just stop for a little bit? Let me recover. I mean, I think it is exciting. I think, though, sometimes teams can find it or employees can find it quite hard that we have to keep shifting and keep evolving because that's what's happening right now. Everything is changing. The public awareness on climate change is changing. The way the energy market is changing. The way consumers interact with the energy market is changing. So you've got to keep moving. Otherwise, we're not actually going to be at the forefront making the change that we've promised to do as part of our purpose.
Can you tell me a bit more about the ethics behind good energy?
Yeah, so what's really interesting about that is that over time, when we kind of look back, we kind of well, oh yes, that's part of our ethics. So I don't think right at the beginning we sat there and going, we're going to be like this and this is how we're going to behave. I think it grew out of experience of working in this industry. So, for example, we are part of a wider business. We're owned 60% by our customers today, so we do believe in... It's a balance between us and customers. So customers and shareholders should kind of be the same thing. We believe in stakeholders. We believe in our employees. So we've introduced, we were one of the first to do a living wage. We also support them with long-term health. We've done a load of work on mental health. We have, I think there's something like 50 mental health first aiders in the organisation. But also we've got a green travel to work support. So if people walk to work, they get an extra bonus. So I think it's grown out of actually how do we want a business to be? And when we look back on it, when you add it all up together, you go, yeah, we're proud of that. We're ethical with our suppliers. We're ethical with our partners. We're ethical with our customers, we're ethical with our employees and with our shareholders. And I think that's what's important is to keep all of those things in balance. And so, yeah, it's kind of grown up around us. But actually, as we've stood back, we've begun to go, yeah, that's who we are and that's what we do.
Everything you've just described is basically creating more work for yourself. So do you ever sit back and think, oh, I wish we could just do it the easy way and not bother with being more ethical?
No, is the short answer. I mean, I think one of the pieces of work that I've been involved in is looking at something called Future Corporation and what is the role of business in our society. And historically, the role of business has been extractive. It's to take value from other people and accumulate it in a big pot for either one person or a bunch of shareholders. I don't think that's sustainable long term for us as a planet. I think businesses have a much larger role in society. They employ people from a local community. They need to be part of that local community and they need to be additive to society. That's why they should be there. And I think that is really important in a world where the issue for us with government seems to be always behind in terms of being able to catch up with legislation, understand how to deal with, for example, the big tech giants like Facebook. Now, if those organisations in their articles of association had their purpose and had ethics built into them, they'd have to comply with them. And so therefore you wouldn't need to kind of keep introducing legislation to try and hold them in a particular framework. So I think my vision is that actually business has become more responsible. And I think it's a really important part. So as well as sort of climate change and renewable energy, I think responsible businesses is a core part of the future of our society.
Is that something that you see as being your role to kind of lobby government to make those changes?
I think part of what we've done at Good Energy is to try and prove that you can run a business that is successful, that can reinvest in what it's trying to do, give a reasonable return to its shareholders, but look after its customers and its employees, and show it as a blueprint. Because one of the troubles about just lobbying government without proof is they tend to be naysayers. They tend to say, oh, well, that won't work, or you can't do that. My vision has always been, okay, so if you tell me I can't do it, I'll just go and do it. And then you can basically legislate that everybody else has to. And that's kind of been the vision for Good Energy. It's like when people said, oh, you can't deal with lots of small shareholders. Oh, well, why not? So that's what we did in our crowdfunding. And then people told us you couldn't deal with lots of small generators. And that's what we did. And we launched something called Home Gen. So we kind of basically launched these marketplaces where people said you couldn't do it. And right now people are saying you can't go 100% renewable energy without lots of this or lots of that. I don't believe that. I believe you can. And therefore that's what we're going to do, is to demonstrate to energy markets what you can do with really good systems, really good customer interactions, and really good management of renewable generation.
Can you say a bit more about what you can do on the try and become 100% renewable energy?
Yeah, so what's really interesting about being 100% renewable is that traditionally this market is always, there's always been a narrative that you can't do this without nuclear. And although nuclear, the existing nuclear that's there, has done a very good job of producing about 18% of our electricity, first of all, it's now not the cheapest low-carbon source. Offshore wind is, onshore wind is, and solar is, so we should be pushing on those technologies. And then we should be understanding about actually, if you bring those together, so one of the things that's quite interesting, and people tend to look at individual technologies rather than systems. So when people talk to me about wind power, they say, oh, but sometimes the wind doesn't blow. But what's interesting about when the wind doesn't blow, they're right, it doesn't blow, but actually at the same time, the sun is probably shining. And even if it's not shining all through the night, you can use short-term battery to manage that. So that it's really trying to, people find it very difficult. They get very stuck on individual technologies. But if you add them all together with smart homes, and when I talk about smart homes, what I mean is that homes that go, oh, well, electricity's a bit cheap now, so I should switch on because there's a load of solar power out there. Or I could switch off because actually the system's quite short and I'll earn some money back. So smart homes will be when your home actually responds to the energy market for you. It manages the solar panel on your roof or the electric car that you've plugged in. And it integrates you into the system, and it does it at the best deal possible for you from a cost point of view and a carbon point of view. That's what I mean. And at the moment, we don't have a vision on that. And that really frustrates me. So I guess that's what my vision is. And I think we wrote a paper probably about 10 years ago about how the UK could be 100% renewable. I think I might need to rewrite it to re-emphasise it. But there's a lot of people hustling for position right now. And I think we just need to have a really amazing vision, a bit like going to Mars. Let's have an amazing vision for going 100% renewable and figure out how to do it. And once we decide on that, we'll do it, I promise you.
What does that vision look like?
What, in terms of actual generation, where it is, what it looks like?
Yeah, and how do we encourage people to sign up for that vision?
So I would love to see a solar panel on every roof in the UK. I don't think any house should be built without integrated solar and absolute energy efficiency. I think we should do a programme, a systematic programme, not through your energy supplier, but a systematic door-to-door programme on improving the insulation in people's homes. I think we should make sure that smart meters are really smart, because right now they just take meter reads. They don't actually help you control your home really effectively. We're beginning to see some of those technologies come through, but we need to fast track that. And then we need to make sure that we're incentivizing households and businesses to use their energy responsibly in a low carbon way. And that for me is the vision. You've got electric vehicles on the system who can take power at different times of day. So if it's really windy, you'll probably switch all your electric vehicles on to take that excess power. You're probably going to have hydrogen. So we start generating hydrogen as a gas that you could put into the gas grid and use that. And you'd use that from offshore wind, for example. You could generate hydrogen. And then I think you've got to look at bio. So what composting are we doing? Are we catching the gases from composting? Are we making sure we're using? So I've seen some brilliant projects in Asia where and Vietnam where local households, they basically generate their own home gas that they cook on through composting. So you know how composting stinks. So if you could think, if you could use that gas to cook in your home, some of them would need to be quite sophisticated, but what a brilliant system that you could actually use all your kitchen waste to then produce energy for yourself to cook on. So I think, I guess my vision is that we start to be much more careful with our energy. We start to think much more sort of creatively around it and how we use it. At the moment, there's no sight of it. So we're sitting in a room. At the moment, you and I probably have no idea what the energy content of this room is. The lights are off at the moment, so we probably know we're not using any electricity. But we don't know how much heat's coming out of the radiators. We've got no sense of that. And that is part of the problem, is that every home has no sense of actually what their energy is doing at any one time, except for trying to see whether it's light or it's hot. And my vision is that every home is automatically controlled, and it knows if you're not there, and it knows when you are there, and it can control, and so it can say to you, actually, it's really expensive right now. Are you sure you want to be? Why don't we switch some other things off that we don't need right now? So that's my vision, is really intelligent homes, really intelligent offices, solar as many places as you can put it, electric vehicles integrated, hydrogen into our gas grid, and as much offshore wind, onshore wind and large-scale solar you can put in as possible.
Wouldn't it be better if we just used less energy overall, but then doesn't that slightly risk putting you out of business, or good energy out of business?
Oh no, not at all. We should use less energy, and we are using less energy. So progressively over the last 3 years, we've seen energy usage in households drop, which is fantastic news. And there'll be two reasons for that. One is, as we heat up as a planet, particularly the UK, will get warmer winters, so we need less heating. In addition, we've improved our electricity usage, so appliances are using less energy. And as we move to new appliances, as you replace appliances, somebody was talking in the office, so we've got this new app we're testing, and it breaks down what all your appliances are using. And one of our guys was using something like 30% of his electricity on cooling. And it turns out he's got a really old chest freezer that's really badly insulated, and it's using most of his electricity. So just being aware of things like that. So maybe he should just switch it off, or maybe he should just get rid of a chest freezer, or get a new one, and then recycle the old one. Or maybe even just look at the insulation around that one. So I think just providing people with information in a way that's really straightforward for them to understand is so important.
As well as setting up quite a groundbreaking energy company, you're also a woman operating in quite a male-dominated world.
Yes.
Can you tell me a bit about what that's like?
So I think it's really interesting. I think obviously I haven't had some of the more traditional issues with being a woman in a corporate world, and I've had some of the kind of horror stories from some of my colleagues who've joined us. Just where you've got sort of male-dominated boardrooms, and they're either women are ignored, or they're given a hard time, or they're never promoted, or they're not paid enough. So I think I've bypassed all those kind of horror stories. I haven't had to cope with those. But what's been quite interesting, the pieces that I've seen are a bit more subtle. So I think one of the things about being a female leader is there are some men who don't like female leaders, and you don't always spot them. And they can be quite subtle about how they might undermine you or not work with you effectively. And I definitely come across a bit of that, is that they kind of think they're better than you. And that's just life. I mean, maybe that's just normal. Maybe that men come across that as well. But that's been kind of a bit of an eye-opener for me, is where men can't work for women. And I think I'm hoping our society will grow up and be able to change that. I think sometimes, I think in the public arena, I think I've always had a pretty good voice, and people have listened to me. I have quite a sort of solid academic background. I think that helps. I mean, what's really interesting, I remember going to Germany once and they kept trying to give me kind of PhDs and things. I don't know why. I think that was just, they assumed I must have PhDs and stuff. And I think being able to, having a scientific background really helps because people can't try and say you don't understand what you're talking about, which is really powerful. So, but yes, I mean, I think that there hasn't been everything that obvious. It's been quite subtle, but yeah, I mean, when you sit in a room with a bunch of other CEOs and they're all men, and if you say something, they kind of all stare at you. That is a little bit intimidating, but you get used to it. Mm. And then you just ignore it after a while and get on with it. So that's the way I've seen it. And I think I'm kind of hoping, it's so exciting when there's more women in the room. It really is. First of all, it's really nice to have other voices. And secondly, you definitely get that diversity. You get much more diversity of speech. You get far more ideas. And my experience is, my senior team now is pretty balanced. There's two women, two men. It's more fun, to be honest. There's less posturing. There's more kind of collaboration. And I think it's really powerful having a mixed team.
In speaking with you, you sound like someone who, when there is a challenge, like setting up a whole new energy company or being in quite, you know, male-dominated worlds, someone who not brushes off the challenges, but just pushes through them quite easily. Do you think that's a fair thing to say?
I think there's definitely a self-confidence. I mean, I think I would find it harder in an area I know less about. So I think because I've been steeped in this industry for so long and I kind of understand it at a fundamental level, I think it makes it easier. And I tend to intellectualize things. So I will think through things and then try and figure out what I think is right and what isn't. So I've used that as a guidance. Would I set up an energy company today? Yeah, maybe. Maybe I would do it again. I think it's interesting, though. There are definitely things I can do better now than I did 20 years ago. And there are definitely things I wouldn't do now that I was able to do 20 years ago. So I think you change as you get older as well.
What kind of things are you talking about?
Well, I have to say, if I'd known how hard it would have been for the first 3 or 4 years of setting up Good Energy, I'm not sure I would have actually embarked on it originally.
Really?
Yeah, I think you have to have a bit of naivety as an entrepreneur. I think it's quite an important trait. Because I think if you know everything, actually you'll never do it. So you kind of, there is a leap of faith that you have to have a belief.
What kind of things were you naive about and that you now look back on?
Cash flow, quite a fundamental thing. Being able to, sort of regulation, not being aware of. So when people say we're going to open markets and we're going to encourage new players, thinking they actually were going to do that as opposed to make it really, really hard to do and having to be the kind of first, I guess, the first people through to try and make a change. So, regulation, belief systems of people saying, well, I don't believe in a green product, or what you're trying to do doesn't make any sense. It's just people work, you can talk to them from a logical point of view, but a lot of people work from a belief system, whether they're academics or investors or financiers, or energy markets and engineers. Most people have a belief system, and it's quite hard when you're trying to bring through a completely new world, challenging that existing belief system.
So it's not just material change you're trying to affect, but also cultural change.
Oh, completely. I mean, it's really interesting. I think one of the big shifts we're going to see in the next 5 years is digitization of energy. So we're going to see a lot more data, and data is going to be the key bloodline of how you manage energy. And traditionally, sort of, I would say 15 years ago, it would have been about the wires. So the wires would have been the most important things, how you get energy from one place to another. And so the companies then were very much led by engineers, electrical engineers who would be thinking about the wires. You're kind of going forwards now, and you're kind of going, so you're going to be seeing chief technology officers becoming much more important because they're going to have to be able to manage huge amounts of data and figure out how to build artificial intelligence systems and algorithms to manage the system through the data.
You're one of the founding members of the Social Stock Exchange.
Yes.
Could you tell me a bit about what that is?
So what that was trying to do, and I think there's an increasing need from it today, is identify businesses who are listed in markets who green investors could invest in. So what it does is it's like a pre-accreditation. So it's saying, this business, we've checked various criteria, so we have to submit an annual report that tells them what we're doing, tells them how successful we've been at doing that, not from a financial point of view, because we do that anyhow in our annual report and accounts, but from an environmental point of view. And so they then go through that, verify that, and that means that investors can be confident that we're doing what we said we were going to do from an environmental point of view.
So if people have money and they want to invest it, but they want to be really careful in what they invest it in, that's something that they could look into.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, the London Stock Exchange has just launched something called, I think it's called the Green Mark. It might be called something else, but it's something like the Green Mark. And we're just one of the first companies to receive that as well. So again, that's like a pre-accreditation for investors to say, if your own investors are saying, please invest us in green technologies or green companies or ethical companies, that's a big tick in the box.
How does Good Energy respond to movements like Extinction Rebellion, who are obviously kind of on the same side as your own beliefs, but are also engaging in illegal activity?
So I think what we've always seen in society is that we need organisations like Extinction Rebellion to shift the view. And what's great about Extinction Rebellion and Greta Thunberg is it makes us feel very uncomfortable, and it wakes us up, because I think quite often you can sleepwalk into situations. Life feels pretty good, the sun's shining, we're walking down the street, I've got somewhere to sleep tonight, I can eat enough food. And so everybody has this level of comfort that nothing's wrong. And actually something like Extinction Rebellion is incredibly important to wake us up. And what's been heart-rending about Extinction Rebellion is when you've seen 80-year-old lovely old men glue themselves to the Treasury and saying they're looking after their grandchildren. These are lovely spoken, they're not... sort of, I think everybody's put Extinction Rebellion in a sort of box of being kind of crusty, swampy type people. And actually the reality is you've got care workers, you've got surgeons, you've got ex-policemen, you've got retirees who would have worked in all parts of our country. And these are the people that are out there. And that's what I think is so extraordinary about Extinction Rebellion, is actually they're showing a completely different side of our society that cares about climate and cares about what we're doing, and is calling government to account. And I personally don't think... So when we saw the Newbury bypass, where sort of protesters took to the trees to try and demonstrate against that bypass, although they didn't win everything there, so the bypass went through, they did significantly shift the way governments looked at environmental protection around road construction. And I think this is what we're seeing here, is that you need organisations like Extinction Rebellion to hold our whole society to account. Otherwise, we won't shift. We need that space. And for us, we embrace it. So Good Energy will get behind it and make sure that we keep the cogs on, make the energy work, make renewables work, reduce household usage, do everything in our power. But we need those guys to be pushing the politicians to be making this change in the regulatory frameworks to do it.
Just going on to my last question now, yeah. Which is the name of this podcast is Stories That Matter.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you had a story from your life. It can be fact or fiction. It can be something that you've experienced or something that you've heard that has really changed or influenced what you're doing now.
It's probably so many is the answer. I mean, I think what's always been interesting, so if I tell a slightly different story, what's always been interesting for me is that over the years I've been asked who's my hero and who have I looked up to kind of take inspiration from. And I always slightly struggled with that question because it was quite difficult. So there were people in the environmental sector, but they were kind of all about lobbying government. And there were sort of campaigners like Extinction Rebellion who've done amazing things. But I never really had a hero. And I found it kind of like slightly, I kind of went, is there something wrong with me that I don't have a hero? What's going on? Why don't I have a hero? What's going on? And then I was on Twitter and I watched this schoolgirl to stand up in front of an audience in a square somewhere in Northern Europe and start speaking about climate change. And she was so eloquent and so on the mark that I completely changed my vision of who my hero was, and that was Greta Thunberg. And she is my hero. She is speaking a truth that none of us have been able to before. And I kind of look at it and I kick myself to go, why couldn't I do that? Why did I spend the last 20 years trying to run an energy company that has been trying to change the world? Why couldn't I be like Greta? But we can't all be like Greta. And I have to kind of carry on doing what I'm doing, which is my small part of changing the way we run energy systems in the UK. But that's not quite a story, but it was so powerful for me, the whole Greta piece. And she's inspired me to keep going. She's inspired me to do more. And I think I'm kind of hoping somebody will tell her story one day, because how she went from a 9-year-old sort of complaining at her parents to be this world leader, because she is a world leader. She will, I'm hoping, make a catalyst to change this planet. And I hope we keep supporting her and protecting her for all the naysayers. So that's not quite a story, but that's kind of what I've experienced over the last kind of 12 months or so, is this coming together of this story. And I feel so much more inspired probably than I have for the last 20 years. And it's so exciting to see her be so successful. And I'm going to keep watching her and keep being inspired by her.
Thanks for listening to Stories That Matter, a Hawkwood podcast. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please do share it with your friends. This episode was produced by Laura Bing, with music by Daisy and her Cora, playing an original composition, Berta.